Lesson 11, lessons learned from Katrina. I want to start off by talking about natural versus man-made disasters. Katrina illustrated one of the unfortunate new realities that we have in our entitlement-minded America. The response of criminals and entitlement-minded people who have nothing to lose to a disaster may be worse than the actual disaster. After Katrina, when they did autopsies on the people who had died, I've heard all sorts of numbers, but one of the numbers that I heard was that of the 1,800 bodies that they found, 1,200 had bullet wounds. Now, part of that is because some gangs knew that the hurricane was coming. They didn't know that the levees were going to break, but they knew that the hurricane was coming, and they knew that people were going to leave, and they saw it as a way to take ground from rival gangs. So they bunkered down, armed up, got their food and water and all of their survival supplies in place, and waited. And once the hurricane passed through, they went out and they took care of business. Now back to the lesson. There's no doubt that Katrina had a devastating effect on Louisiana and Mississippi, but many of the biggest lessons that we can learn from the event had to do with what happened afterwards. Most of the horror stories of Katrina were man-made. On one hand, that fact sickens me. But on the other hand, it means the lessons can be applied to all disaster situations, and that the people who went through the experiences didn't do so in vain. Timing is everything. The first lesson that we can learn from Katrina is the importance of timing. Regardless of the disaster, if you decide to bug out, you must make sure that there is still a practical way to do so before you leave the driveway. People who left New Orleans early had no problems at all. The roads were clear, gas stations had gas, food and drinks, bathrooms worked, and the hotel rooms were available just a few short hours away. As an example, in the days before Katrina made landfall, the travel time from New Orleans east across the Twin Span Bridge was only 15 minutes. As more last-minute evacuees started leaving town, that travel time increased to 17 hours. The problems weren't linear, but rather compounded as time went on as a result of cars running out of gas, accidents, and a lack of available fuel. From talking with people who were there, it was like someone slammed a door shut. There were several factors that compounded the problem, but one of them was that many evacuees started out with near-empty gas tanks and were prepared for a 15 to 20-minute drive across the bridge. They were not prepared for 17 hours with their engines idling. As the cars ran out of gas, they blocked the cars that did have gas. And again, it was like someone slamming a door. One of the biggest factors came into play between the period of 24 hours before the storm hit and 12 hours before the storm hit. It was during this time that almost every gas station within 100 miles of New Orleans ran out of gas. And more importantly, they stopped getting resupplied. One man reportedly, and this I can't verify this, so take it. It's really not worth anything. It's just a story. But one man reportedly paid $1,000 for a tank of gas during this time. In addition to running out of gas, convenience store supplies were wiped out, including toilet paper for the bathrooms. If you are ever in a mass evacuation like this, it will be important to keep your food and water close to you and hidden. Also, eat and drink discreetly so that you don't get wiped out by people around you who are in need, and see that you have food and water. If your vehicle permits, it would be smart to have multiple bags or containers of food and water so that if necessary or advantageous, you can show people a single small bag or cooler and appear to have very little. If you have a problem with the mentality of not sharing your survival provisions with other people who are in need, that's fine. I understand that. And I'm really, really glad that there's people like that. Just make sure to game it out in your mind in advance. You need to decide whether it would be easier for you to watch your loved ones or strangers complain that they're hungry and thirsty. You've got a choice. Who do you want to see suffering? Don't wait until you're in the middle of a disaster situation to address these questions. Predetermining your decisions for these kinds of moral dilemmas when you're well-fed and rested will allow you to act decisively and efficiently when you're operating under stress. As an example, imagine being stuck on the Twin Span Bridge for 17 hours. People will not live or die because of dehydration based on whether or not you share water during a 17-hour situation. They may suffer, and they'll probably be uncomfortable, but they won't die if they keep their head screwed on. On the other hand, your strength, your ability to see, your brain's ability to communicate with your muscles, and your brain performance will start dropping noticeably when you're dehydrated by as little as 2 quarts, or roughly liters. If you weigh 100 pounds, or 4 quarts, or 4 liters, if you weigh 200 pounds. Keep in mind that you will lose this amount of fluid to sweat and bodily functions in as fast as 1 to 3 hours if you're hot and under stress. The same applies to food. People around you may, quote-unquote, suffer some if you don't share your energy bars and other food with them, but they've got weeks before they're in danger of dying of starvation. On the other hand, if you run out of food because you shared too much of it, you are going to start experiencing an increase in irritability and a loss of mental and physical function due to low blood sugar. The loss of this high-speed functioning due to either dehydration or low blood sugar is not something you want to have happen in a survival situation, especially if you're surrounded by other hungry, thirsty, irritable people. Just remember that the people around you made a conscious or unconscious decision to not be prepared, just like you made a proactive decision to be prepared. Unless you're a few days into a disaster, giving away your survival provisions won't make the difference between life and death for someone else, but it will hinder your ability to operate at 100% if you run out of food or water. Now, this doesn't mean that you shouldn't share anything with anyone. If you have your provisions split up, you can easily show someone a small cooler with a few bottles of water, fruit, sandwiches, bars, etc., and tell them, hey, you know, I don't have much, and I don't know how long we're going to be here, but you can have some. You can still be a good guy. Just do it smartly. Next, don't believe everything that you see and hear on TV. Many of the breakdowns of post-Katrina were related to communications, and one of the biggest problems was misinformation spread by the media. TV, radio, blogs, and newspaper reporters were all too happy to publish any horrible story that they were told. Horrible things did happen after Katrina, but nothing like what was reported in the news. There were reports of horrendous crimes at the Superdome, including babies with slit throats, but they were never found. And, I mean, my gosh, if you do know of it, and you can tell me who happened to, or send video, or police reports, or anything, please do, because if it did happen, I don't want to say that it didn't, but so far, there's been no proof whatsoever that it did happen. There are just stories, and the media latched onto and ran with them as quick as they could, and then other news sources took the initial stories and ran with them and assumed that they were true, and they just weren't. There were also reports of thousands of bodies floating in the streets and quote-unquote snipers shooting at helicopters and cannibalism. Now, there were bodies floating in the streets, and I have a link on the resource page to the pictures, but there weren't thousands. And there were stupid thugs shooting at helicopters because they were stupid thugs, but they weren't snipers. And there were no substantiated reports of cannibalism. This was just a wild story. Unfortunately, there was a real consequence to this irresponsible reporting. Steve Saylor from iSteve.com said it best with this observation. Sure, rumors outrun the reality, but think about what it would be like to be a cop or fireman who is supposed to go out in a boat and rescue people. You're putting your life vest on because there's a chance some desperate survivor in the water might pull you in. But then your wife rushes in and says the reports of thugs. It did say snipers, but I changed it to thugs. Your wife rushes in and says that there are reports of thugs shooting at rescuers, and she insists you put on your bulletproof vest instead. But that's heavy and would drag you right down to the bottom. So you say, screw it, I'm calling in sick. Now, I changed snipers to thugs out of respect for true snipers. It just, it really, really irritates me when the media is disrespectful to the military or inaccurate with firearms. Sorry about that. But anyhow, back to the meat of this. If you were a police officer and knew that this kind of activity was going on, would you stay home and protect your family and your neighborhood? Or would you go out and try and protect people who might thank you by shooting you? Compound this with the fact that 80% of New Orleans police officers reportedly lost their houses to the storm and subsequent flooding, and two-thirds of them basically quit the department after the levees broke, and you've got a serious staffing problem. Now, these news reports had consequences. They emboldened criminals, they broke the already fragile will of much of the New Orleans police department, and they made ordinary citizens more scared than they needed to be. The takeaway here is that you need to have a good mental filter in place when you listen to the news after a disaster. Don't believe everything that you hear, and don't let news that you don't have any control over affect you. Remember that it's the job of TV and radio stations to keep you tuned in for as long as possible, by whatever means necessary. It's not their job to help you survive or to give you accurate, actionable information that you can use to survive. It's a bonus when they do this, and I'm sure they sleep better at night when they do their little puff pieces, but their primary purpose is to keep eyes and ears tuned to their station and watching and listening to their ads. It's important to realize that all of this misreporting was most likely the result of simple sensational journalism and a thirst for ratings rather than a coordinated, malicious effort of putting out misinformation. The reporters in New Orleans didn't want to hurt people. They didn't want to kill the will of the police officers. They didn't want to embolden criminals. They were just doing their job, and they didn't have time to do fact-checking. And so they went with the story that was the most exciting and likely to get people to stay on the channel the longest. We'll discuss this more when we cover the mental aspect of survival, but if you don't have control over how your mind deals with news, it will react to sensational journalism as if it's true, regardless of whether it is or not. Next, adapt and overcome. 17 television stations and 79 radio stations were forced off the air by Hurricane Katrina. In an example of adapting and overcoming, FEMA still managed to get pertinent information out to residents, telling them about dangers to be aware of, locations of shelters and aid stations, and how to deal with waste and water issues. How'd they do it? By printing up flyers and delivering them door to door. Now, you might be wondering why I just made a really nice compliment of FEMA. It's not really that good of a compliment. Unfortunately, in what looks like a rare success for FEMA, they screwed this up as well. You see, firemen from across the country volunteered to go to New Orleans and Mississippi to help out in the wake of Katrina. FEMA decided that they all needed to get trained up in Atlanta before being deployed to their assignments. Their training in Atlanta included 2 days of training on workplace sexual harassment issues, and when they did get deployed, these firemen, who had all sorts of skills that would have been very helpful, they were tasked with handing out flyers rather than rescuing people or providing medical care. A quick note on FEMA. CERT is under FEMA, the Community Emergency Response Team. And I'm part of CERT, and I'm a big fan of CERT. And as a result, I kind of have to be a little bit of a fan of FEMA. And I've got friends who are national first responders for FEMA, and they're good guys. And that's not who I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the first responders that help with FEMA, the first responders that help with CERT. What I'm talking about is anytime you get a very large government organization that isn't incentivized for performance, you're going to have some really, really screwy things going on, like spending 2 days teaching firemen about workplace sexual harassment issues and then having them deliver flyers door-to-door instead of having them help save people who are in high-water situations or trapped in houses and buildings. So next, don't expect help if communications are down. While some of the communication problems involving the media made the aftermath of Katrina worse, there were many other communications issues that caused problems as well, and serve to emphasize the point that you need to be able to take care of yourself after a disaster. Starting at the local level, 52 emergency or 911 communication centers were disrupted. Some had to be evacuated due to flooding, and some simply did not have adequate backup power. This was the result of not having generators, having too few or too small generators, not having enough fuel, or having generators in locations that flooded. It was accidents. It was poor planning, but it's frankly stuff that we can learn from. Even in the areas that did have operable 911 centers, many radio repeaters were inoperable, crippling police, fire, and EMS communication. A quick clarification on that. Radio repeaters repeat radio transmissions. Police, fire, and EMS use repeaters so that a responder can use a relatively weak radio to communicate with a dispatch center that may be several miles away. When they start transmitting, their signal is picked up by the repeater and rebroadcast from a higher elevation with more power. Crossband repeaters do the same thing, but they allow agencies on different frequencies to communicate, like fire, EMS, police, the feds, and different jurisdictions. With 911 centers, repeaters, crossband repeaters, and basically everything else inoperable, and many vehicle-mounted radios flooded, interagency communication stopped as well. In the days when most regular emergency communications were down, four of the most reliable forms of communication were courier, shortwave radio, satellite telephones, and plain old family radios. Many agencies did not have enough of these, and even if they did, they didn't have batteries on hand, or enough batteries on hand. As state, National Guard, FEMA, Coast Guard, private security, and outside first responders started to arrive, and shelters started to be set up, the communications problems intensified. Not only were the different agencies operating on different frequencies, they used different jargon when communicating. Among other problems, local people used landmarks when giving directions that had no meaning at all to outsiders. I'm telling you about these problems for a couple of reasons. After a disaster, assume that you're on your own, even if the city is full of police, fire, and EMS. If someone, namely police, fire, or EMS, tells you they're going to contact someone to help you, don't believe it until you see it. The intent may be there, and they may do it, but in reality, they may not be able to guarantee help with so many constantly changing variables and communication problems. Number three, if you have the tools and skills to choose to be a volunteer, you could be of tremendous value as a radio specialist who can bridge the communication gap between agencies. In addition, outside first responders and private security will likely need local communication help, and relief shelters will need assistance in reaching EMS and police if they don't have the appropriate equipment. A good parallel to this is the relationship between private security forces and NGOs, or non-governmental organizations, in war zones. The NGOs typically want to come in and help, but they need and want local help specifically they need help with local knowledge, communications, and security. Next, good luck getting help with medical and trauma. This is sad, but it's the truth. For several days after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, only one hospital, which was Ochsner Medical Center, was able to take new parents. Other hospitals were used as evacuation points, but weren't able to accept new patients due to staffing, water, food, and electricity issues. Built in 1951, the founders of Ochsner Hospital knew that it was only a matter of time before the levees would fail, water would be compromised, and the city would need a working hospital. As a result, Ochsner drilled its own redundant wells, installed redundant generators that were higher than the levee, and build up their food stores. Most importantly, the entire structure was built up high enough so that flooding from the levees would not be an issue. If you work with a company or organization that needs to keep working efficiently after disaster, Ochsner is a great case study. They supplied food and lodging for their employees and even some of their families, not to mention that they figured out how to handle regular payroll for those working in advance as well. They ramped up staffing for multiple shifts before the storm so that they could stay operational through the storm, after the levee broke, and until order was restored. it also is a great study into the cost of doing the right thing after a disaster. Oxner provided over $80 million in unreimbursed medical care after Hurricane Katrina, even though other hospitals in the parish that were not even operating got reimbursed by FEMA. There was an aid ship that was out in the Mississippi River, and it cost $1 million a day. And by late November, it still had not seen a single patient, and it was just sitting there at $1 million a day. Most other hospitals in New Orleans and Mississippi were not so well prepared. One of the big problems that they all faced was record keeping. Some hospitals in Mississippi lost all electronic and paper record keeping capacity. What this meant is that 49% of patients entering the EMS system were not able to be tracked by family members, and there was no record of their prior care, treatment, or diagnosis as they moved through the EMS system. Many were moved by the busload to other states without tracking or without notifying family. One close protection specialist from New Orleans told me about one of his friends who got hurt. He was actually in a coma. His girlfriend of 7 years took him to a parish hospital for help, but wasn't able to get any updates on his condition after he was admitted. Even though they owned a house together, the hospital refused to tell her the condition of her, for all intents and purposes, husband, or even where he was. It turned out they had transported him to another state almost immediately without telling her. It took over a week to find someone who was willing to break the law and tell her how he was, where he was, and how to even see him again. Now, once patients got to evacuation hospitals, fuel shortages caused waits of several hours to a few days for transportation to a hospital out of the damaged area that had the space and manpower to actually admit them. In all cases, whether operating as a hospital or as an evacuation point, hospitals had severe security problems dealing with the walking worried who were looking for friends and loved ones. Lack of accurate records meant the only way to know whether or not the person you were looking for was at a particular hospital was to go looking for them. In most cases, these walking worried were honestly looking for family and friends. In other cases, they were thugs who used the opportunity to steal hospital drugs, supplies, and patient belongings. In all cases, the sheer number of people passing through caused patients to have a lower level of care and increased their chances of getting secondary infections. Hospitals had as many as 20 times more patients than normal, and with their normal supply channels cut, they quickly ran out of drugs and supplies. With the help of local law enforcement, some hospital employees improvised and overcame the problem by scavenging local pharmacies until shipments from outside sources started arriving. Why am I telling you about the breakdowns in the medical system? Well, because in addition to serving as another warning not to depend on others after an emergency, I want to stress the importance of avoiding activities that could put you in the hospital, such as physical conflict, driving in areas without traffic signals, running out of needed medication, and physically exerting yourself if you normally live a sedentary life. By practicing de-escalation, conflict de-escalation, slowing down or stopping in intersections, and pre-planning your medication and staying physically fit, you can avoid many of the most common reasons that cause people to need EMS care after Katrina. Next, stay away from shelters. I'm going to start out by saying that I'm not going to be critical of the people who ran shelters, worked at them, or volunteered at them after Katrina. They were in a no-win situation, and for the most part did a great job under absolutely terrible circumstances. That being said, post-Katrina shelters suffered from being understaffed and lacking necessary security, food, water, bedding, medical supplies, hygiene supplies, and toilet facilities. Add to that an incredible lack of support from local government, and it's amazing that anyone got helped. Churches offering shelter after Katrina were oftentimes overrun with refugees that were unloaded at their door by city officials. After taking in refugees, these shelters were on their own. They didn't have radios or any way to contact police or EMS other than sending a runner, and their emergencies had to be prioritized with all the other emergencies coming in at the same time. This meant that shelters had to provide their own security, medical, counseling, food, cooking, water purification, and janitorial services. As with any population, there were refugees at the shelter who were alcoholics, smokers, illegal drug users, and people who took drugs to control mental illness. I'm not grouping these people together for any reason other than the fact that they all shared a common link of increased irritability when the substances that their body were dependent on were no longer available. The result was fighting, people throwing chairs through stained glass windows at churches, toppling statues, defecating on floors, walls, and a general lack of control. In one case in Mississippi, SWAT teams had to be called in to restore order because people who ran out of medications required to keep their conditions under control began to be a threat to themselves and others. Another serious problem with the shelters is universal. Anytime you put a large number of people in close proximity, add stress, add a lack of sleep, and inadequate bathroom facilities, you're going to have an increase in sickness. This only compounds the existing problems. If you're in a disaster where shelters have been set up, you've got to try to avoid them at all costs, unless you're choosing to help at one. Once you enter a shelter as a refugee, you'll lose your belongings, weapons, and any tools that the shelter workers think you could use to defend yourself, or, in fairness, hurt them. The sick irony is that you may not get any more food or water than if you'd stayed away from the shelter and fended for yourself. You'll also have to put up with horrible attitudes, whining, people with entitlement mentalities, and your sleep will likely be interrupted by snoring, arguing, kids blasting music, crying, the threat of violence, and other interruptions that you wouldn't have if you simply holed up on the street somewhere with others and took turns sleeping. After Katrina, shelters were so overrun that many didn't have any record of who was there or who had been there. Families who were split up for intake sometimes got bused to completely different shelters with no record of where their child or spouse or elderly parent was sent. The lesson here is whatever you do, don't put yourself in a position where you voluntarily get separated from your family or group. The areas surrounding the shelters were also very dangerous. This is where a certain contingent gathered, including criminals who refused to give up their weapons, people who got kicked out, and drug dealers looking for customers. In a survey of 100 drug users who were in shelters after Katrina, most said that they had no trouble finding their drug of choice within one block of the shelter. Now, ironically, most pot smokers said that they stopped using after the storm so that their thinking wouldn't be impaired. If you live close to a structure that has been declared a shelter area after a disaster, you should seriously consider relocating to a safer location as soon as possible, preferably to the home of someone on your mutual aid team. I'm from the government. I'm here to help. Yeah, that's kind of funny. Centralized approaches to disaster relief failed miserably after Katrina. As an example, there were over 100 helicopters flying over New Orleans within 48 hours of landfall of Katrina. They were flying 24/7, saving people, but FEMA still hadn't given agencies the green light to start flying and was actually telling first responders to stay away. The 100 helicopters were the result of Coast Guard, National Guard, and just independent helicopter owners completely ignoring FEMA and deciding to just take care of business. More insidious was Mayor Nagin's order to disarm citizens and force residents to leave their homes. These next couple of paragraphs are very difficult for me to write, as most of my close friends are either military or law enforcement. For the most part, the Army and various National Guards respected people's rights to stay in their homes. News reports on YouTube reported that the National Guard did force people from their houses, but the actual videos that are labeled as National Guard actually show police entering the houses. At least one National Guard officer appears to have told his troops to use intimidation, including drawn weapons, to encourage people to leave their homes. However, they weren't authorized to actually force people out. Now, I don't agree with this stance at all, and it really troubles me that the officers in charge appear to have blatantly ignored the Constitution, but for the most part, National Guard units did a good job of restoring order. With the prevalence of hack job reporting and video editing, this may or may not have even occurred. Again, Videos of Guard soldiers and police were often spliced together in Michael Moore fashion to create stories in the viewers' minds that may or may not have actually happened. There are videos online that take comments out of context and make Guard troops look very bad. I encourage you to dig a little bit every time you see a video like this. After watching about 6 hours of YouTube videos on Katrina, I was able to quickly recognize sound bites that were taken out of larger interviews. In one case, a soldier was asked about shooting fellow U.S. citizens. In the soundbite version, his response was set to really cool rock music, and they make it appear as if he was looking forward to shooting Americans. Contrast that with the full interview. The guy was kind of broken up, and he was lamenting how he'd rather be in Iraq, where the threat was insurgents, and how much he thought being forced to shoot another American troubled him. I am defending the Guard troops here. It, frankly, is an emotional, visceral stance that I take, and I want to be clear about it. I'm not taking a neutral stance. If anyone sends me substantiated, verifiable information about Guard troops, I will update this lesson, the resource page, and include it for future students. 2,000 students have taken this course at this time, and none of them have sent any videos or anecdotes, substantiated or otherwise. Now, unfortunately, law enforcement was another story. There's much dispute about how widespread law enforcement abuse was, but there's no doubt that it happened. There is one widespread story of a frail lady named Patricia Coney who was assaulted, forcibly removed from her dry, stocked home, sent to South Carolina, and not allowed back to her home for a month. While the officers who assaulted her were California Highway Patrol officers, unfortunately, local law enforcement was complicit in covering up the offense and sending her out of state. Local law enforcement also entered homes and disarmed residents, stopped cars and disarmed occupants, and stopped boats and disarmed passengers. In a few cases, the firearms were returned undamaged, but in most cases, they were returned damaged or destroyed or not returned at all. The NRA has a great video on this that they sell that goes into a lot of detail on it, and they've done a lot to try and get the firearms returned back to their rightful owners, and it's been very sad how much the different government agencies have stonewalled the attempts to get these people back their firearms that they own that were basically stolen from them. In at least one case, the firearms were beaten against the pavement until the guns were inoperable right in front of the owners. I've got a link to a video interview with some of the people who had their guns taken on the resource page. I encourage you to watch it yourself so that when you talk with people who doubt that anything really happened like this after Katrina, you can tell them with conviction that gun confiscation did happen and that the Second Amendment was violated, the Fourth Amendment, which is search and seizure, was violated, and the Fifth Amendment was violated, which is due process. People weren't arrested and taken to a prison where they were guarded and fed. They were simply detained and disarmed. Watching the interviews will give you real-life situations that you can use to game your response in case you find yourself in the same situation. If you want to keep your guns in a post-disaster situation, here are three of the actions you can take if you're confronted by anti-self-defense, anti-constitutional law enforcement that don't involve conflict. Now, first of all, depends on when you listen to this as to what the number is, but several states have passed laws since Katrina saying that in the event of martial law or an emergency, that states and law enforcement do not have the right to confiscate weapons from people. So that's a good thing. It's basically just reaffirming the Second Amendment. But here's some of the things that you can do. Live in a state that prohibits gun confiscation when a state of emergency has been declared, or push for the legislation to be passed in your area. Number two, lie, hide your guns, and or give one as a decoy to the police and hide the others. Now keep in mind that this may or may not be illegal, so check with your local laws, and I'm not going to encourage you to do anything illegal. And number three, get on the other side of the law by joining your local sheriff's auxiliary, search and rescue, joining your local CERT, which is the Civilian Emergency response team or community emergency response team, depending on who you talk to, or getting licensed for armed private security in your state. Now, none of these are guaranteed to give you a pass when you're dealing with an Orwellian law enforcement official, but they will improve your odds considerably. Another strategy in this vein is to team up with the family of a law enforcement officer so that you can claim that you have your weapons to protect the family of a fellow officer. Again, there's no guarantee that it will work, but you will want to exploit as many emotional triggers as possible to find the ones that will allow you to stay armed. Next, thank God for Bubbas and Rednecks. Shortly after word got out about the levee failing, New Orleans was quickly swarmed by people from the bayous and swamp country in shallow bottom boats. This wasn't a coordinated effort. They just all knew that people would be in need in the city, and they wanted to help. Some of these Cajuns barely spoke English, and most people from the coast would call them Bubbas, Rednecks, or Hillbillies out of contempt. You know, I'd call them that too, but I'd call them that out of respect and out of shared values. These guys were heroes. They rescued people who were stuck in trees, stranded on rooftops, and trapped in attics. They didn't need anyone to tell them what to do. They just went out and took care of business. They didn't get paid a dime. They did it on their own dollar. They took risks. They left their families at home to go and help other people. They were a model of what people think of when they think of America and what they think of when they think of the best of America. Now, after any disaster, you'll likely see the Bubbas and Rednecks coming out of the woodwork to help those around them. They're good people to befriend, even better people to be, both before and after disaster. Ironically, these good Samaritans had a hard time finding shelter, food, water, and fuel. Most of the hotels that were operable in New Orleans had a policy of not letting anyone in after the storm. On one hand, it made sense because they would have been overwhelmed if they started letting people in. But it's still very unfortunate because they turned away volunteer rescue workers as well. If there's a local disaster in your area and Bubbas and Rednecks start showing up to help, do what you can to help them, whether it's giving them a safe place to sleep on your back porch, food, water, gas, or anything else you can spare without sacrificing operational security. Next, criminals will come out of the woodwork. Books, TV shows, YouTube videos, and independent films have been made about the horrible crimes that happened after Katrina. I'm not going to detail them here. There were carjackings, boatjackings, murders, racial attacks in all directions, robberies, smash and grabs, rapes, beatings, etc. Unfortunately, none of those were uncommon for New Orleans before Katrina, and they're still quite common today. Basically, thugs did what thugs do when they think they can get away with it. They steal things and hurt people. Next, withdrawal sucks. Now, one way to capitalize on this is to stock up on cigarettes, chewing tobacco, and or Nicorette to barter with after a disaster. Keep in mind that the average smoker smokes 15 cigarettes a day, and that withdrawal symptoms are worse during the first week and are made worse by stressful situations. After Katrina, 52% of smokers increased their smoking by more than half a pack a day on average. If you're a smoker and you think this is cruel, well, there's two things you can do. Go stock up on cigarettes, or stop smoking now so that you don't have to go through withdrawal in a disaster situation. I don't mean to be cruel at all. It just is what it is. A legal way to stock up on something that will likely go up in value after a disaster that has an illogical, emotional component to it. As a bonus, cigarettes can't be used as a weapon on you like bullets. They don't make a person violent like alcohol. And they don't take away from stuff that your family needs like food. Cigarettes will always have a barter value where dollars, silver, or gold may not be practical. Keep in mind that as high as 15% of the general population is on antipsychotic drugs. Antipsychotic drugs include antidepressants. They also include drugs for all sorts of other mental illnesses. Psychotic sounds like a crazy word. It's really not. It's just problems with the brain. More specifically, problems with chemical levels in the brain. Doesn't mean there's a problem with the person. But what this all means is that several people taking this course will either be on antipsychotic medication or live with people who do. Some people will be taking the drugs for social reasons, other for minor problems, and a small percentage take antipsychotics so that they don't have to be hospitalized. To those of you taking antipsychotics, I can't emphasize enough how important it is to have as much medication on hand as possible. You know how you are off your medication, and a disaster is not a good time to be anything less than 100%. If you are able to eliminate any drugs that you're currently taking without serious negative side effects, you will be better off. I want to strongly encourage you to go to the Mercola Clinic in Chicago and see if they can help you control your condition without prescription medication. The URL for the clinic is naturalhealthcenter.mercola.com. If you can't get off of your medications, then have a talk with your doctor and try and get ahead on your prescriptions, even if that means paying out of pocket. Next is riding out the disaster. This is in part the theme of the entire course, but there are quick few lessons that were made particularly clear after Katrina. First, scavenging is not looting. Some people do disagree with me on this, but I consider looting an act of personal enrichment or taking someone else's survival provisions. I've created a 2-question test that I will use in urban survival situations. Number 1, is there any chance that the owner will return and need this item for survival? And number 2, do I need this item for survival? So, the only case when I would take something that wasn't mine would be if the owner had obviously abandoned the item and I needed it for survival. Otherwise, I wouldn't take someone else's belongings. I spoke with 2 private security contractors whose daily routine included finding abandoned cars and siphoning the gas from them to power the generator at the hotel they were protecting. It was relatively easy to do without harming anyone. They simply found a car that had been destroyed by a tree. They'd knock on the door of the house that was in front of it, if the house still had a door, and make sure that there weren't people in it still living in there, and then they take the gas. This is much different than stealing food from a house where people are living, taking widescreen TVs from appliance stores, or stealing gas from drivable cars that people are using. Next, regardless of the disaster, if you retreat to your attic, have a way to cut through your roof if exiting through the house may not be possible. Several dozen people were trapped in their attics after Katrina for 2 to 3 days. Some died, and one man survived 18 days trapped in his attic. I have a link on the resource page for a roof hatch called the Katrina Hatch that may be a good solution for you if you live in a hurricane-prone area, or it may inspire you to create something similar. Next, generators attract looters. UrbanSurvivalStories.com tells about one thief who stole 36 generators after Katrina. He would take a lawnmower on low idle in the middle of the night, put it by a home generator, idle it up over the course of 10 minutes or so, and then take the generator without the homeowner knowing what happened. There are a few solutions to this problem, including chaining your generator, using dogs as a sentry, running the generator in your garage and venting the exhaust to the outside, installing or fabricating a muffler, buying or fabricating a generator cabinet that is secured and helps muffle the noise, or improvising an alarm system. Next, adults with special needs, children, and the elderly all got transported to general shelters without identification, medical information, contact information from relatives, or required medication. This happened to hundreds of people and was not isolated to a particular city, race, age, or organization. In some cases, the medications were seriously needed. When the patient's drug levels started dropping and they began showing signs, the personnel at the shelters had no idea what they were dealing with. Violent encounters occurred, including at least one where SWAT needed to be called in to restore order. And the situation could have easily been prevented with medic alert bracelets or dog tags. If you, an adult relative, or someone you take care of becomes dangerous to themselves or others, or non-communicative when they're off their medications, consider getting them to start wearing either a medic alert bracelet or necklace, if they aren't already. In addition to their name and condition, it should have your name and emergency contact information. Try to have both a primary and secondary means of contact on the tag, if possible. I've even seen people with diabetes get tattoos saying that they have diabetes. this seems a little extreme, but you know what? If you're doing a lot of things where you aren't going to have a medic alert bracelet on for whatever reason, it's something to consider. Next, protect your first responders. One of the biggest problems that we've seen after recent hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, the 9/11 attacks, and the Oklahoma City bombings is that the first responders may accomplish superhero feats, but they're still human and subject to sleep, food, and water requirements. In addition, they have families that they worry about during any downtime that they get, and they've got to work through the things that they're seeing. If you're not currently a first responder, there are a few things that you can do to help people who are. Number one, get medical training. CPR and first aid at a minimum, and EMT or OEC or Wolfer training if possible. Any treatments that you can provide to yourself, your family, your team, and your neighbors will take the load off of the EMS system and centralized treatment areas. Number two, get CERT training. This will give you a broad base of post-disaster skills that, again, you can use to help yourself, your family, your team, and your neighborhood. If you have or intend to get firearms, take formal training to learn how to use them. The more you can do to be able to take care of yourself and your family, the better. Said another way, the more self-reliant people there are in a city, the lighter the load will be on first responders. As you get to know first responders who live close to you, ask them if they would like you to look after their family, pets, and house in the event of an emergency. Most families who have addressed survival issues have only one key person. In first responder families, this one key person will likely be taking care of others rather than being able to take care of their own family. Your help will allow them to mentally check off that box until they get the rest of their family up to speed, and could be a welcome relief. There's an assumption that neighbors will take care of each other, but having something definite in place will allow their subconscious mind to relax. While they're risking their life to help others, they won't need to be thinking, "Why am I here? My family needs me." And next, if first responders are operating in your area after a disaster and you don't have the skills to help them, offer them food and water and ask them if there's anything else you can do for them. You can even go door to door in your neighborhood asking for people to pitch in. This will build a good sense of community as well as possibly give you good intelligence on how your neighbors are doing and what supplies they have. Get to know the disaster protocol for first responders in your area. One smaller jurisdiction near a large city that I spoke with has the following plan in place. When a state of emergency is declared, all first responders are to report to work and are expected to hot bunk until the state of emergency is over. They're expected to have their families trained and able to take care of themselves. A local school will be available for all first responder families to go to, should they wish. Shelter, cooking, supplies, water, fire, security, and basic medical care will all be provided for first responder families so that the first responders don't have to worry about them. Police, fire, and EMS are expected to have the same attitude as if they were in the Guard or Reserve, got activated, and got deployed for an unknown period of time. Now, more common is the following, especially in larger jurisdictions. Anyone who is working will continue working for the duration of the emergency. Anyone who is not working will first get their family squared away and then report for duty for the duration of the emergency. Families are on their own. If you live in an area that's small enough to go with the first plan, you may want to see if local authorities would be open to you helping them put such a plan in place in return for being able to take part in it during a disaster situation. If you're serious about implementing a plan like this in your area, please contact me. The jurisdictions that have taken this approach are pretty tight-lipped about it, and I may or may not be able to put you in contact with them. The decision is not up to me, but I will help you to the extent that I'm able. If you are a first responder and already have protocol in place, please let me know what it is, and anonymous is fine. And just let me know on the resource page or through email. So this chapter, here's the big takeaway. Start identifying first responders in your neighborhood and talking with them as time and opportunity permits. When you feel it's appropriate, mention that you're reading about police, fire, and EMS after Katrina, how many of them were worried about their families while they were working, and ask if they have a plan in place for taking care of their family while they're working during and after a disaster. If they don't have one, Tell them that you'd be more than happy to help them out if it's ever necessary. So there's a lot on the resource page for this lesson, and I encourage you to go to it. Simply go to urbansurvivalplan.com/483.